and topological information about a link complement starting from a projection diagram. It's kind of an ambitious goal because you can start with any old diagram of a knot or link. Maybe it's a messy diagram, but maybe you can simplify it into a nicer diagram where the combinatorics of the diagram actually tells you geometric stuff. So here are a few questions that I'd like to answer and that I'll hopefully go some way toward answering in this talk. Is first of all, can you tell from the diagram if this is actually a hyperbolic knot or link that you're looking at? Does the complement have a complete hyperbolic structure? If it is hyperbolic, what can you say about its volume? What can you say about its length of geodesics? If you take a particular arc in the projection plane, are those arcs, can they be straightened by isotopy to hyperbolic geodesics? And finally, a slightly more topological question is, what can you say about the surfaces that live in this link complement, ciphered surfaces or other surfaces with some particular slope on the knot as boundary? What can you say about the genus of such surfaces, etc.? So the tool that we use to answer these questions is to cut up the manifold, to cut up the link complement into angled ideal tetrahedra. So let me first tell you about what those angled ideal tetrahedra are, and then I'll go on to talk about some very specific knots and links. So angled ideal tetrahedra are modeled on regular old ideal tetrahedra in hyperbolic space. Since this is an audience of hyperbolic geometers, I probably don't need to say very much about these, but I guess the main information is that the shapes of ideal tetrahedra in hyperbolic 3 space are parameterized by dihedral angles. You pick a triple of dihedral angles that add up to pi, and you get a tetrahedron. So around each ideal vertex, they add up to pi, and because that property has to hold at every ideal vertex, you actually get the fact that opposite angles are equal. And the cross-section at a cusp, if you cut this tetrahedron by a horosphere, you get a Euclidean triangle. And you could actually do all the constructions that I'm doing with bigger polyhedra that are not tetrahedra. They're also parameterized by dihedral angles. So I don't know if you guys were in Richard's talk, the last talk, I guess before Jeff Brock in the morning, but he talked a little bit about parameterizing bigger polyhedra by their dihedral angles. You can also do that, but I'm just going to stick to tetrahedra for now. So when you glue these tetrahedra to construct a manifold, to construct a cusped manifold, what you want to do is make sure that the angles line up in the gluing. So right now we're looking at an edge of the manifold head-on. So here are a bunch of sectors of tetrahedra around that one edge. These red arcs are pieces of the truncated triangles at the ideal vertices, and you want the angles there to add up to 2 pi. This is definitely a weaker condition than the regular hyperbolic gluing equations that you might want to do to get the hyperbolic structure. All you're asking is that the angles line up, but the lengths, the side lengths of these triangles, don't actually have to line up. So what's happening geometrically is that you have a shearing singularity along the edge. I guess if you're looking at hyperbolic space in the upper half space model, and in this case we're looking at it head on, so the boundary plane is the screen, we're looking at one of these edges, then Euclidean rescaling is a hyperbolic isometry that translates along one of these edges. So the singularity is a translation singularity. If you wanted to glue this tetrahedron to this tetrahedron, you would have to shear it along that edge. So that's called a shearing singularity, and the structure with these singularities is called an angle structure. It's definitely weaker than a hyperbolic metric because we don't quite have everything lining up. So then one natural question to ask is, why would you spend your time studying these triangulations that don't actually give you the hyperbolic metric if what you want is information about the hyperbolic geometry? And I'll try to give you several answers to that question. But the first answer is, well, you study these things because you can. Why climb Everest? Because it's there. These tetrahedra are actually amenable to being studied because there are lots and lots of triangulations of this sort. So just to compare, if you want to get a hyperbolic metric by solving gluing equations, you have to solve a nonlinear system of complex valued equations. Each tetrahedron is parameterized by a complex number. They have to line up around each edge. Mostel-Prasad rigidity tells you that you have at most one solution to these gluing equations, and as Francis told us in the very first talk at the conference, when something is unique, that usually means it's hard. So getting a hyperbolic structure just by solving gluing equations is definitely hard. On the other hand, getting an angle structure by solving these angle equations is a lot easier. So all you have to do there is solve a linear system of real-valued equations and inequalities, where the equations, there are two types of equations. For each tetrahedron, you want the angles to add up to pi. Around each edge of the gluing, you want the angles to add up to 2 pi. And finally, because you want the tetrahedron to be positively oriented, we ask that all the angles are positive. So that gives you some inequalities also. So you have a system of equations, you have a system of inequalities, and the solution set to all this, if there are indeed solutions, is a convex precompact polytope in Euclidean space. So it's a very nice convex set. Its closure is compact. Its interior describes all of these angle structures. A second answer to why you might want to study angle structures is that they give you a lot of combinatorial information about the surfaces that can live in the manifold. So this goes toward answering one of the questions that I posed on my first slide. And the way that works is that whenever you have a surface in the manifold, you have a tetrahedra partitioning the manifold, you can ask how the surface and the tetrahedra intersect. And they're going to intersect in a bunch of disks. You can push things around until the intersections are really, really nice. And it turns out that for every disk of intersection, there's a nice combinatorial way of estimating the complexity of that disk called combinatorial area. So what you have to do is for each disk, you count the external dihedral angles whenever it hits the edges of the tetrahedron, or maybe it goes all the way out to an ideal vertex. In that case, it goes all the way out to the cusp. Well, there you have an internal angle of 0, an external angle of pi. You take all these external angles, you sum them up, you subtract 2 pi. So in this particular example, you get 13 pi over 12. And what that formula is motivated by is that it matches the formula for hyperbolic polygons. When you take polygons in the hyperbolic plane and glue them together to get a surface, well, you have the Gauss-Bonnet theorem that says that the area of the surface is minus 2 pi times the Euler characteristic. And in fact, the combinatorial area satisfies the same relationship. So this was one of the first facts about angle triangulations observed by Andrew Kasson, who was really the person that I should credit with introducing this whole field of study. So right away, by counting the dihedral angles of the tetrahedra, by counting the combinatorial areas of surfaces that can live in the tetrahedra, you get information about the complexity of these surfaces, and that also has useful applications to Dehn surgery, because if you take a knot complement, you fill some particular slope, and you want to make sure you don't get a torus after you fill, you want to get an atoroidal manifold, that means that upstairs you don't want to get any punctured tori, and you just estimate the Euler characteristic of the surfaces that live in the knot complement, and that can give you useful Dehn surgery results. A third reason, and this is starting to get more powerful, is that the very presence of an angle structure tells you that there has to be a hyperbolic structure that exists. The manifold has to be hyperbolic, at least in principle. So we don't know what the hyperbolic structure looks like, but we do know that whenever we have an angle triangulation, a hyperbolic structure has to exist. So this is a theorem of Andrew Kasson, and later written down by Mark Lackenby. And the idea is you use Thurston's hyperbolization theorem for Hockin manifolds, in particular for manifolds with boundary, that says that your manifold is going to be hyperbolic so long as there are no essential spheres, disks, tori, or annuli. And these are surfaces in the manifold. You can study these with combinatorial area and use combinatorial area to rule out essential surfaces of this type. So spheres and disks, well, they have positive Euler characteristic. That means negative area. You can't have negative area. So that means that right away you know that those things can't happen. And tori and annuli, well, they have to have zero combinatorial area. That can happen, so it takes a little bit more effort, but it turns out that they can also be controlled. And what you get is that the tori have to be boundary parallel. That's okay. We're allowed to have boundary parallel tori. And that the annuli have to be compressible. Basically, any annulus that you get has to be a tube that runs around one edge of the gluing of the tetrahedra. And that's very, very compressible, so we definitely don't have to worry about annuli of that sort. So you can't have any spheres or disks, tori or annuli, which means the manifold has to be hyperbolic. You don't know what the hyperbolic structure looks like, but you know it has to be hyperbolic. In order to get a hyperbolic structure, you actually can do this with angle triangulations, at least in principle, but you have to study them more in depth. And what you have to do is to study the volumes of these tetrahedra that you're gluing together. So for each tetrahedron, there's a very explicit way to calculate its volume. It's a sum of three Lobachevsky functions. This character right here is the Russian L in honor of Lobachevsky. So you take the three dihedral angles that parameterize the shape of your tetrahedron. You add them up. That tells you the volume of the tetrahedron. You add that up over all the tetrahedra in your gluing, and you get a volume associated to an angle structure. Now remember, we had a whole large polytope of angle structures. There's a whole large dimensional polyhedron of different shapes, so you can think of this volume function as being a function on this polyhedron. Every point in there gives you a different angle structure, gives you a different volume. And you can study the properties of this volume function on the polytope. And the theorem about this stuff of Riven, Chan, and Hodgson is that if you have a critical point of volume somewhere in this polytope of angle structures, then that point gives you a geometric triangulation. So in particular, that point gives you the hyperbolic metric on the manifold. So in practice, if you can prove that there exists a critical point, then you're going to get a hyperbolic metric. And another thing that's very easy to prove about this volume function is that it's concave down, which means any critical point you get is going to be a global maximum. And that means that you get some other information. If you have a global maximum somewhere inside this polytope, well, that means that any other angle structure that you get, you calculate its volume, and you get a lower bound on the volume of a manifold. This can be an effective way of getting lower bounds on volume. And also, because you've constructed this manifold out of what are now geometric tetrahedra, that means that all the edges of the gluing are now hyperbolic geodesics. If you want to do this for a knot, and the edges are arcs in the projection plane, well, now you know that those arcs in the projection plane are hyperbolic geodesics. So the summary of all this stuff is that here's a program for getting information about the geometry of a link, and in fact, this works for more general cusped manifolds. It's just that I'm focusing on the example of links because I like to draw knot pictures. So the step one of the program is you start from some sort of nice diagram of a knot. You do want the diagram to be sufficiently simplified that everything works. You use this diagram to partition the complement of the knot into tetrahedra. You get an ideal triangulation. Like I just said, typically the edges are going to be arcs in the projection plane. Then, once you have a topological triangulation, you can write down the system of linear equations and inequalities that it has to satisfy. The solution set to that is going to be your polytope of angle structures. You want to prove that it's non-empty. Then once it's non-empty, once you have angle structures, that already means that your manifold is hyperbolic. But in fact, you can go further if you can prove that the volume function is maximized at an interior point of this polytope. Then by the theorem on the last slide, you actually know what the geometric structure looks like. And you can even do better than that. There's a bonus, which is once you have a lot of information about dihedral angles, you can look at these tetrahedra in the Minkowski model of hyperbolic space. So this is the hyperboloid model in R4. And by studying convexity in Minkowski space, you can actually prove that this triangulation is geometrically canonical, which means it's dual to the Ford domain of the manifold. So you get a lot of information this way. And generally speaking, something like this is very hard to prove with other methods. So what I'll do with the remaining time is I'll go through a couple different families of knots and links and kind of show you how far you can get with different types of hypotheses, with different types of knots. The simplest example and the example where we get the best information are two bridge links. So a picture of such a link is going to have two maxima at the top, two minima at the bottom, and between the top and the bottom you have a four-string braid descending. And in particular, in the complement of that braid, you have a product region of the form four punctured sphere cross an interval. I guess already at this conference, we've heard a lot about product regions of surface cross interval and understanding their combinatorics, understanding their geometry, I guess you can think of another example of the sort. So if you take this four punctured sphere cross an interval, glue the top to the bottom, you get a bundle. If you close things off in a slightly different way, then you get this knot complement. And it's been known for, I guess, over 20 years now, exactly which ones of these two-bridge knots and two-bridge links are hyperbolic. Specifically, there's a theorem of Monasco that says that they're almost all hyperbolic. The only exceptions are these 2n torus knots. So that's when the four-braid is actually a two-braid. And that theorem uses Thurston's hyperbolization theorem. It uses some very, very big tools. And what we do with angled triangulations is we reprove this theorem from scratch, plus we get a little bit extra. So we construct an angled triangulation. We prove that the volume is maximized in the interior, so you actually get a geometric triangulation. You know what the geometry of this link complement looks like, and we can also prove that it's geometrically canonical, so you actually know that this is the right triangulation for this knot complement. You also get a couple of pretty neat corollaries. So one of them is a conjecture that Moram and Thistlethwaite made a little while ago, which is whenever you have a reduced alternating diagram of an alternating knot or link, reduced diagram just means you don't have any sort of stupid extra crossings that you can untwist and remove. Whenever you have a reduced alternating diagram, you conjectured that any arc at a crossing, so an arc like this, or an arc like that, or an arc like that, all those arcs are, first of all, isotopic to geodesics, and they're also isotopic to short geodesics. So we prove this in the case of two-bridge knots. So what does it mean, first of all, for these things to be short geodesics? They're infinitely long. They're geodesics between cusps. But if you take a neighborhood of the cusp, if you take some sort of maximal neighborhood, then you can actually measure the length of geodesics. And relative to the maximal cusps, these are some of the shortest geodesics out there. In particular, these are all edges of the canonical triangulation, which one way to think of constructing it is you take a horball neighborhood of each cusp, and you grow all the horballs until they touch, and then you grow them some more. So you construct an edge between the closest pair of horballs, and you keep growing them like balloons until they start to expand and touch along faces. Anytime two horballs touch along a face, you construct an edge between their corresponding points of tangency on the boundary. So all the edges that are all the arcs at crossings of the projection plane arise as edges when you do this construction. So in a sense, they are some of the shortest edges between the cusps. So that's a pretty neat corollary. And a second corollary is a volume estimate for two-bridge knots. I guess for alternating knots and links, we've known for a little while now, for the past 5 years or so, starting with the work of Mark Lackenby, that the volumes of alternating knots and alternating links are definitely related to the combinatorics of the diagram. What you have to do in the diagram to estimate the volume is count the number of twist regions in the knot. So a twist region is where the strands of the knot wrap around each other some number of times, creating a bunch of bigons in between. So here's one twist region, here's a second twist region. There are four in this picture. If you count the twist number of a reduced diagram of an alternating knot or link, then you get upper and lower bounds that are proportional to that. And in our case, our angle triangulation improves the best known lower bound for two-bridge knots. So the upper bound is not very hard to get. The upper bound comes from Dane surgery. The previous best known lower bound was a theorem of Ian Eagle, Pete Storm, and Bill Thurston that relied on Perelman in a very major way. It used a lot of Ricci flow techniques to estimate the volume. So we circumvent all of that machinery just by constructing these angle triangulations. You get a nice volume estimate on that. I should say what the constants are. V8 is the volume of a regular octahedron, so that's about 3.6. And V3 is the volume of a regular ideal tetrahedron, so that's about 1.01. So if you put in the decimal values of these numbers, the gap between the upper and lower bounds is less than a factor of 6. So you get pretty good information about exactly what the volumes of these things are. So moving along to the family of arborescent knots and arborescent links, this is a generalization of two bridge knots. Thank you very much, Francis, for letting me use this picture. So what arborescent links are is you take a bunch of bands, unknotted bands in R3, you put a bunch of twists in the bands, and then you glue them together along rectangles. You plumb them together, you get this large arrangement of unknotted twisted bands, and the boundary of the surface is going to be a knot or link, and that's exactly what arborescent knots and links are. So this is a very large family. It includes all two bridge knots, it includes all pretzel knots, includes all Montesinos, knots and links. So there's definitely a lot to do there with arborescent knots. I should say that the term arborescent was coined by Dave Gabay, who, I'm sorry to say, is not, sorry? Larry Zeeberman, I'm sorry. I should credit Larry Zeeberman with coming up with the term arborescent. It means pertaining to a tree, and the reason is that the combinatorics of the gluing of these bands is actually very nicely described by weighted trees. So here's how that works, is if you take a planar tree with weights at the vertices, here's how it encodes the combinatorics. So each vertex of this tree corresponds to a band, each edge corresponds to when you glue two bands together, the weights correspond to half twists in the band. So here's an example where I've drawn the projection flat instead of those spatial bands. It makes it a little bit easier to see what the knot's going on. So for the central vertex, there are three edges coming out of it, which means here's a band with three things glued to it. The weights are -1 and 2, so here's -1 half twist, here's +2 half twists, and then to it we glue a band with 3 half twists, a band with 2, and then a band with -2 and 4 over there. So here's an example of an arborescent link represented by a tree. And there's a lovely theorem of Bonahan and Siebenmann classifying exactly which ones of these are hyperbolic. Basically, almost all of these links are hyperbolic. There are exactly 3 special families of exceptions. So family number 1, we've already encountered. There are 2 bridge knots and links. So when you have only one band with some number of twists in it, those guys are definitely not hyperbolic. Exceptional family number 2 is when you have 2 separate link components that are isotopic to each other, and there's a strand of the knot or 2 different strands of the knot that run twice through there, so they each bound a separate twice punctured disc. Those are definitely obviously non-hyperbolic also because you have this cylinder, this annulus. And there's a third special family of exceptions, which are certain small pretzel links with particular number theoretic conditions where you put P crossings over here, Q crossings over here, R crossings over here. There's a normalization that says that P, Q, and R are each at least 2. That's just saying you put it in a certain special position. And then the last condition on there says that the numbers actually have to be at the same time fairly small. The sum of the reciprocals has to be at least 1, and then those are not hyperbolic. It turns out that when the sum of the reciprocals is equal to 1, then there's an incompressible torus, and when it's strictly bigger than 1, then they're Seifert-Fibered. So those are not hyperbolic. But apart from these 3 special families of exceptions, all the rest are hyperbolic. And what Francois and I do is we reprove this theorem using angle triangulations by subdividing the link complement into angle tetrahedra and also some slightly bigger pieces that are topologically solid tori, but they're still angled in the proper sense, which means by Thurston's hyperbolization theorem that these guys, in fact, do have to be hyperbolic. So for this family, we only really prove existence of a hyperbolic metric. We don't actually tell you what it looks like because, unfortunately, the combinatorics is so complicated that we can't get all the volume maximization stuff to go through, at least as of right now. But we do know that we can construct these angle triangulations, which tell you that the link has to be hyperbolic. So in the few minutes that are left, let me tell you what the construction looks like and what this triangulation looks like that makes it all work. So what you have to do is focus on these product regions, of 4 punctured sphere across an interval that lie in the complement of a braid. I guess for 2 bridge knots, it's pretty clear how they occur. It turns out that for an arborescent knot, such product regions occur in many different places of the knot. And specifically, you look at this weighted tree, and whenever you have a linear subtree of this tree, whenever you have a bunch of vertices just strung together end to end, that defines a four braid, and in the complement of this four braid, you have a four punctured sphere cross an interval, and we want to triangulate this four punctured sphere cross an interval using pleated surfaces. So we're going to associate a different pleated surface to each crossing of this braid. In this case, the pleated surface is going to be a four punctured sphere, so we're going to stick in a bunch of different four punctured spheres in this product region, one associated to each crossing, and they're going to be pleated, they're going to be bent along certain edges. And where are they pleated? Where are they bent? It turns out that for each one, we have a very specific way of subdividing that sphere into ideal triangles. So for each sphere associated to a crossing, there's a natural way to get an ideal triangulation of it, which is you look at that sphere immediately outside the crossing, you look at that sphere immediately inside the crossing, and you look at the arcs in the projection plane that are just vertical or horizontal in one place or the other place. So these green arcs are horizontal both inside and outside the crossing. These blue arcs are vertical outside the crossing, but once you isotope things toward the inside, they become diagonal. On the other hand, on the inside, the red arcs are vertical. You move them out, and over there they become diagonal. So you have a bunch of these pleated four punctured spheres pleated along these arcs, and whenever you have a neighboring pair of pleated surfaces, there's some three-dimensional space in between, and that three-dimensional space is exactly what gives you the tetrahedra. So here's another way to look at where the tetrahedra come from. You start with a four-punctured sphere on one side of the braid, you end up with a four-punctured sphere on the other side of the braid. I should say that this whole picture is happening in the fairy graph, which is the curve complex of a four-punctured sphere. So the different curves in the four-punctured sphere are naturally identified with rational numbers. It turns out that the vertices of this graph correspond to slopes, the edges correspond to disjoint or minimally intersecting slopes or arcs that don't intersect at all, and the triangles of this graph correspond to triangulations of a four-punctured sphere. So you have a fairy triangle over here that corresponds to a sphere on one side, you have a fairy triangle somewhere else that corresponds to a four-punctured sphere on the other side of the braid, and then you're walking from one to the other through this fairy complex, so you take a right turn, and another left turn, where a right turn corresponds to a crossing like this in the braid, a left turn corresponds to a crossing like that. And if you zoom in and focus exactly on what happens every time you cross an edge, so we're focusing on this edge that we're crossing in the fairy complex, well, we're going from this four-punctured sphere to that four-punctured sphere. We're doing an exchange of diagonals. So slopes of 0 and 1 are staying in the triangulation, but the slope of infinity is being replaced by a slope of a half. So here's the picture. On the bottom here, you have a four-punctured sphere, or at least a fundamental domain of it, triangulated with slopes of 0, infinity, and 1. And up above it, you have the same four-punctured sphere triangulated with slopes of 0, 1, and a half. When you superimpose the two triangulations on top of each other, you start to see the tetrahedra. And that's where the tetrahedra of the triangulation come from. So you layer all these tetrahedra on top of each other, and you get a triangulation of a four-punctured sphere across an interval. Then you have to glue these triangulations together in a special way, but I think I should probably stop here because I'm running out of time.